Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is David Liebert. He's been the road manager for a number of legendary rock acts, artist manager, musician, songwriter, producer, and agent, and we're continuing our conversation about his new memoir, which I considered a must-read, Rock and Roll Warrior, My Misadventures with Alice Cooper, Prince, George Clinton, Living Color, The Runaways, and more. David, welcome back to the show. I had to do part two. This memoir is that good.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Mark.
Now, you've throughout your decades working in that business, you have to have come across some really difficult people. I mean, you can't interact with venue owners and bands and stuff like that and not run into some really difficult people to deal with. Like, there's a story in your book about dealing with Bill Graham of Fillmore.
Yeah.
He didn't sound like a very pleasant person to deal with.
Well, he was sort of a dichotomy of sorts. Socially, if you weren't doing business with him, if he were just out, you know, socializing,
yeah,
he was great. He was smart. He had a great sense of humor. He was terrific. But he had this whole other side when you did business with him. He was very aggressive and confrontational. He was, you know, he was a scary guy. He was like a big brute, so to speak. So, yeah, I had my...
you dropped the F-bomb on him.
Yeah, which I learned very, very quickly, almost instantly. That's the one thing you don't say to him. He just went nuts on me, and I learned never to, no matter what happened, I learned never to say that to him again.
Whoops.
I talked about it in the book. We got into a very contentious type of argument, and I threw the F-bomb at him, and he went nuts, I said, oh, my God, I'm going to be killed. This guy, he's much bigger and tougher than me. And I was afraid that in that moment he was going to destroy this persona that I spent months building to give people the impression that I worked for, that I was tough and all-knowing, I was in control. But, you know, you kind of have to be that way.
Right, you have to do that. Otherwise, people aren't going to listen to you.
Yeah, they're just going to walk all over you, all of that's going out the window. So I said, there was a room with a door open right next to us when he grabbed me. So I tried to grab him and sort of tumble into the room, and I figured at least my demise would not be witnessed by everybody backstage. And fortunately, at that moment, a bunch of the roadies jumped in to separate us. Which I suppose negated my imminent demise. Well, and then, of course, since we were separated, I regained courage, and I told him, you're lucky my boy stepped in. Otherwise,
oh, God.
Ass Bill, you know, and he just wanted to kill me after that. But, you know, he ended up doing a lot of Alice Cooper concerts and was involved with a lot of Parliament Funkadelic concerts.
Yep,
I guess we knew how to deal with each other, so to speak. So we didn't, things never quite got that much out of control. Although there were other pretty contentious incidents with Bill Graham. It was just in his nature, I suppose.
I think other bands have and managers have stories about Bill Graham too.
Yeah, they do.
Now, on the other complete end of the spectrum, you've also toured with a lot of people, which just sound really fun, and I just need your insights. Flo and Eddie, from who I've seen them perform separately, and I've seen them perform with Frank Zappa. And they're two of my favorite people. What were they like?
They were wonderful. I mean... The reason they did so many Alice Cooper tours supporting Alice was they were just great to have around. Alice,
I can imagine.
Them.
Yeah, That's what they
were fun and personable, and they certainly made my job easier on a lot of levels because, you know, we always leased a large commercial airliner for every tour, and part of my job as a tour manager was I would get on the PA, the airplane PA system every morning. Because it was the one place where everyone was together, and if you needed to disseminate tour information, let everybody know something, that was the place to do it. And having those guys on board, they would augment my my morning announcements with you know, with their routines, and they were hysterical. And and they made my job easier because it wasn't my sole responsibility anymore to keep everybody amused. I now had professional comedic backup, which I was very grateful for. And I don't, Mark, I don't know if it was because I made sure that they were afforded every possible perk and privilege that a big traveling rock and roll tour had to offer. But some 40 years later, they filed a lawsuit against SiriusXM and Pandora.
Yeah.
For those companies not paying them when they were in the Turtles, playing their these companies playing their songs without their permission.
Oh, wow.
And it started a whole big thing in the music industry, and the majors followed suit. And in the end, these lawsuits were settled for well over $330 million. It was a class action lawsuit. And today, bands that the older bands that were really not being paid their fair share of streaming revenue get a much bigger share of the streaming revenue because of their a lawsuit against these companies. And it was so influential that Congress actually passed a law called the Music Modernization Act soon after the lawsuit was settled to make it a law to make sure that everybody gets their artists get their fair share of revenue. So I owe them a lot. I'm living more comfortably today because of them. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Howard.
And yeah, I hope somebody writes a good book about them at some point because they're so interesting. They start out in the Turtles. They went on to Zappa and did years with him and then went on and toured on their own. And they have an interesting story. Now, I saw one of the Alice Cooper tours that you must have been the manager for because they toured with Susie Quattro. And I saw it in Boston, I think. And Susie Quattro opened for Alice Cooper. And you write a little bit about her in the book. That's a tough opening act, by the way. Alice Cooper is a very tough act to open for. Did you ever find out that acts didn't want to open for Alice Cooper? Because how can you open for that act?
No, it was never a problem, Mark, because first of all, everybody wanted to open for Alice Cooper for a number of reasons. First of all, it was so much damn fun being on tour with, you know, the Alice Cooper entourage, and you get to fly in the plane with your band and crew, and so it wasn't a downside.
However, didn't you write that she didn't like to fly?
She didn't. Airplanes made her quite nervous, and but she really couldn't refuse Alice Cooper's offer to have her fly along with her band and crew free of charge for the entire tour. I mean, who's going to turn that down?
Oh, my God.
No matter how nervous you are about being on an airplane. But on that particular tour, when I had negotiated the lease for the airplane, I threw a little something in for myself, Mark. I negotiated a couple of flying lessons, which really didn't amount to much more than after the plane took off and achieved altitude and the airspeed and was well on its way to the next town, I would, you know, steer the plane for a couple of minutes, all under the watchful eyes of the pilot, of course. But this was a having David Liebert behind the wheel of a big commercial airliner, I guess, was a little more than Susie Quattro had bargained for. And I remember at the end of that first lesson when I came out of the cockpit, she was there waiting for me. And in the nicest, sweetest way, she said, "David, I'd really appreciate it if you wouldn't fly the plane."
Yeah, no offense, David, but I don't want to look up through the cabin door and see you behind the wheel.
I can understand that. So, having satisfied my curiosity about what it was like to steer a great big plane, and also because I really love Susie Quattro. She's a wonderful
person. She's a fantastic person. And she hasn't gotten the cred, I think, that she deserves.
No, she was tremendously. You speak to people, any successful female musician,
yep,
they idolize Susie Quattro because she was really the she's the one that was the path maker for all of them. I mean, I'm friendly with Cherie Curry from The Runaways. She says if it wasn't for Susie Quattro, I never would have had a career. And I've had a lot of successful women musicians say the exact same thing to me. Yeah, she was a trailblazer, Susie Quattro.
She was.
You're right. She doesn't give the credit that
she deserves. Now, we're going to go to a totally different phase of your life. You've had such a life. Now, everybody, you know, Alice Cooper, outrageous. I dug it. It was fantastic to see Alice live. But in 1975, you moved to the West Coast.
Yeah.
And you start to get, you're now involved with George Clinton, Parliament, Funkadelic, and Bootsy's Rubber Band. Now, if there was ever a group of people that I think were even more out there than Alice Cooper, that's the group.
Yeah. Well, the truth is Alice Cooper, put aside his reputation, was a pretty normal guy, really. He was easy to hang with. He wasn't a prima donna. I mean, he's a guy that played golf with Perry Como. How nuts could he possibly be? George Clinton and that whole P-Funk organization was the complete opposite on a lot of different levels. And I suppose what I brought to the P-Funk party was all this experience I had with logistics and production. Because one of the things they had in common, Alice Cooper and George Clinton, was a rather complex production, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, George had a giant spaceship land on stage.
You know, again, people today have no idea how out there that group was when you saw them live. First of all, their music is outstanding. But
but
when you saw the stage show, it was like nothing else you'd ever seen. I mean, it was psychedelic funk. It was and this spaceship lands. It's like, holy moly. It was definitely out there. It was just absolutely amazing. What was it like to work with George Clinton?
It was more difficult than working with Alice Cooper, that's for sure. You know, the whole Alice Cooper thing was a very well-run, well-oiled machine, and it ran very smoothly. George was a lot more chaotic just because of the way he was and the way he ran things. But I was able to bring to the party, like I said, some semblance of sanity as far as his production goes. So I ended up looking pretty good because I was able to apply a lot of what I had learned being with Alice Cooper to a lot of his production quality. George is a very, very clever, very bright guy, but very
stoned,
street smart. You know, very, I'll give you a perfect example. I mean, all of George's drug connections were after him. He wasn't the greatest payer in the world.
Oh, God.
You know, they got pretty angry with him, and they got to a point where it was like, George, pay up or else. What did George do? he had them all come to the studio and sign recording session sheets for the money he owed them, as if they were like, you know, additional musicians that he hired, and then sent the session sheets to the accountant of the record company, and that's how he paid off his drug debts.
Oh, my God.
I mean, how streaked could you possibly be?
Talk to me about Bootsy. Boy, talk about one person who, to this day, I just love Bootsy's music, Star Child and all that. I mean, Bootsy's Rubber Band. Yeah. Bootsy has got to have been even further out there.
Well, Bootsy is a strange sort of guy in that as much as George liked to be on the road and be on tour and do live performances, Bootsy really didn't. He really didn't like the road. And I mean, he liked being a star, and he liked collaborating with other musicians on various projects. But he really didn't like the road. So it was increasingly difficult to, you know, to manage his career, because he'd rather be in the studio producing people and doing, you know, various kinds of things musically other than being on the road. So
that's really interesting.
So it was like pulling teeth. He just hated everything about it. And, you know, once in a while he couldn't avoid it, like when we did Woodstock 99. And he was going to do a walk-on with George, and he's fiddling with his gear behind this large prop. And I'm going, Bootsy, get out. You know, what's wrong with this? You know, there's only 10 minutes left of the P-Funk set, and Bootsy, you're going to miss your opportunity. And when I'm just ready to really lose it, he turns it to me. I mean, I'm hiding behind, you know, a stack of speaker cabinets. He turns to me, he winks, he nods to his tech guy. Moments later, he kicks the prop that he was hiding behind out of the way, and there he is. Crowd goes nuts. He looks around, gives him that big toothy smile of his. Funk walks his way to the front of the stage, and being pretending to be completely oblivious to the enormity of this moment in front of 200,000 people, he leans his 6.5-foot frame into the microphone and goes, "What's happening, y'all?" The crowd goes absolutely berserk. So, you know, he was. He knew how to be on stage, how to perform, how to milk it for all it was worth. Just didn't like it all that much.
Well, the amazing thing is, you were also managing the Brides of Funkenstein, who I happen to have all the recordings, and Evelyn Champagne King, who a lot of people don't remember.
She had a huge hit.
Shame was her big hit, right?
Yeah, just enormous hit. I was her booking agent, and she was barely 18 years old at the time.
Oh, wow.
I was able to get her the support slot on an OJ's tour, so I did right by her. And
wow.
She and she was great. I loved that record. It was the height of the disco age. And
yeah, it is.
Records of all time during that
I have so many. There's so many people in your book that I just found it interesting. Kim Fowley. Now I'm old enough that I remember Alley-Oop. He was one of the Hollywood Argyles.
He was, yeah.
And Alley-Oop was a huge song when I was a kid.
Your age is showing, Mark.
I know. I just had my birthday yesterday. I'm not going to mention it. Okay. He wrote songs for Kiss. He wrote songs for Alice Cooper.
He did, yeah.
He was the producer of Helen Reddy's albums?
Is that wild?
That's totally out of it. I can't believe that.
I know.
But most of all, he was the manager and producer of The Runaways.
Yes.
And now, how did you get involved with The Runaways?
I was sharing an office with Toby Maimus, who, you know, he's co-manages today, co-manages Alice Cooper along with Shep Gordon, but he had a PR firm, Famous Toby Maimus, and I rented office space. And he was friendly with Kim Fowley. He's the one that introduced me to Kim. Kim was one of the strangest people I've ever known. He had this brutal, confrontational demeanor. I mean, he might have been the most offensive person. He had no filter. He would just say things, the most insulting, just the most awful things to people, you know.
Well, you in the book, you talk about a run-in he had with David Forrest, which just basically consisted of him essentially beating up David Forrest and saying, give me the check.
Yes, yes. That's how he dealt with it. The Runaways, I was their agent, and we put a show together at Santa Monica Civic. It was the perfect place for the Runaways to play L.A. at that time, and the show sold out, and we had Cheap Trick as the opening act.
Oh, man.
And, I couldn't seem to get the check from the certified cashier's check from David Forrest. He was avoiding me. He was annoyed with me because we had a couple of run-ins over this date as booking agents and promoters sometimes are prone to have. And, I was following him around. I just couldn't seem to extract a check from him. So I told Kim. And Kim just walked around behind him, screaming at the top of his lungs, give me the check, give me the check. He must have said it 100 times, give me the check, causing such a commotion backstage that David Forrest really didn't know how to deal with any of this. So he's got his accountant, here's the check, here's the check.
We're going to run out of time, and I'm not going to mention all the bands that are in your book by any means. But one band that sticks out because of your admiration of them is Living Color.
Yeah.
We were talking about bands that I don't think have sort of been as well remembered as they should have been. And from the get-go, I always thought Living Color was great. It was just absolutely amazing. And Vernon Reed was brilliant.
All of them. They were, Vernon, and they were phenomenal musicians. I think they were one of the greatest live bands that ever existed. They were absolutely amazing, and I was in awe of them. And it was really an honor to represent them as their manager. I admire them for not just their talent, but their work ethic.
Yep.
These were four extremely disciplined, well-informed, politically astute, fascinating guys. And to this day, Will Calhoun, the drummer, is one of my closest friends. And I remember inviting my good friend Carmine Appice, the drummer for Vanilla Fudge, Carmine's history, to a show in Southern California, a Living Color show. And we were watching the show together, and I said, So what do you think of Will Calhoun? And Carmine says, are you kidding? This guy is, unreal. And he just went on and on about how fantastic a drummer he felt that. Will Calhoun may arguably be the best drummer in rock. It was really, and I felt that way about all of these guys. Doug Wimbish was a phenomenal bass player. Corey Glover, he had this incredible voice, and he did. And these guys, all of them had outside projects beyond Living Color, doing all kinds of things. Will worked with Mos Def, and Vernon worked with a lot of different people. They all had projects outside of Living Color. It was the only way they could satisfy their insatiable desire to create musically with all kinds of things, other projects. Yeah, I love those guys. They're terrific.
Do you think they may have been among the most musically astute people that you've met in your life?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. You mentioned they don't really get the credit they deserve. Well, you know, they had broken up for 10 years, and somehow or other I was able to convince them to, get back together. And very successfully, I might add.
Yep.
But I think the fact that they did have a 10-year downtime in between their initial success and then getting back together, I think it costs them dearly in the long run. Yeah. Otherwise, I think they probably would be revered as one of the greatest bands that there ever was.
Yeah, I'm waiting for them to be rediscovered. You know what I mean? Like, I'm really waiting for them, for all of a sudden somebody to write a big article, and then everybody starts getting into Living Color again.
Yeah, that would be great. Wouldn't they deserve it?
Yeah. We only have like minutes left, and I wonder, you actually got to meet Guns N' Roses early on in their career.
Yeah.
You have been all over the place, man.
Yeah, I actually got a call from Kim Fowley one night and said, he was out of town. He said, Lever, go check out these guys. I think there's something special. He told me where they were. They were living in a storage locker.
Jesus.
Where they lived and rehearsed. And it was a storage locker. Other bands lived in their respective storage lockers, and sort of an odd, wild situation. Anyway, I went down there and they just blew me away. It was, you could see the songs were fantastic. And these guys, as crazy as they were, spent hours every day rehearsing. In that regard, they were very disciplined, and it was obvious to me that there was no way that they weren't going to make it.
We're going to have to stop there. We've run out of time again. My returning guest tonight is David Liebert. He has been the road manager for a number of legendary rock acts, as you can hear. Artist manager, musician, songwriter, producer, and agent, and we've been talking about his new memoir, which has everything we've been talking about and a lot more. Rock and Roll Warrior, My Misadventures with Alice Cooper, Prince, George Clinton, Living Color, The Runaways, and more. David, it's been a pleasure.
Always, always fun to talk to you, Mark. Thank
you
so much.
Anybody that remembers the Hollywood Argyles is good in my book. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.